On this episode of The Playbook, you have to check it out. Google this name, Bradley Tusk, a name you'll never know, but without it, the world would not be the same. There would be no Uber, no Bird, no Lime, no DraftKings, no FanDuel, and no Lemonade. That's just a few of the things that he has been the catalyst for. Using his skills, knowledge, and desire without limiting his point of entry.
This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer.
All right, this is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs The Playbook. And I have Bradley Tusk.
Hey, how are you?
Tusk Ventures, Tusk Philanthropy, Tusk Holdings.
Yeah, all kinds of things with my name on it.
Well, you know, you're a true entrepreneur, and we probably don't have enough time to go through all the different things that you're involved with.
Sure.
But one of the things that most entrepreneurs want to know from someone that's highly successful is, how did you get there?
Yeah, so my path was super weird. And the way that I got to venture capital is I had spent about 20 years working in government and politics. I was my Bloomberg campaign manager. I'd be the deputy governor
20
of
years.
Illinois. Yeah, that's 45. So I started when I was about 18 to about 17, 18 years. I'd been the deputy governor of Illinois. I'd been Chuck Schumer's communications director. And I started my first company, and it was a political consulting firm that runs big campaigns for big companies. And that's what I was doing, and I was working. And then in 2011, I'm sitting in a meeting, and a friend of mine called and said, hey, there's a guy with a small transportation startup. They're having some regulatory problems. Would you mind talking to him? I become Uber's first political advisor that day, and then I get really lucky when Travis calls you back and says, I can't afford your fee, we just take equity.
Oh,
and
man.
For not, I didn't know what I was saying yes to, you. But I said yes. That was a Series A. I then spent the better part of the next 5 years just kicking the shit out of the taxi industry all over the U.S. to make ride-sharing legal, because probably a lot of people who watch this remember, taxi industry tried to kill Uber in every single city.
Yeah, they had in New York.
New York, but yeah, Vegas, Miami was a really tough one.
Right.
They had the inside game, which they had lobbyists, and they'd been giving out campaign contributions for decades. So we said, let's go on the outside instead and mobilize collectively a couple of million Uber customers to weigh in politically, to advocate from their phone, to advocate over Twitter, email, Instagram, whatever it was, and that overwhelmed the inside game, and we won. And so that was really how I got started in tech, and then it occurred to me that there really was no one focused on that intersection of tech and politics. And yet, if you build a successful startup, you're going to run into all kinds of regulatory and political issues, because by definition, when you're taking market share away from somebody else, and that's what most new good startups do, is they succeed by taking away someone else's market share. Airbnb's taking away the hotel industries, Uber Taxi, and so on. You're going to have political problems pretty fast. So our thought was, if we could identify startups that have incredible growth potential, but for some sort of gating political problem, and then go solve that problem, value of our investment goes way up. So for example, in Fund One, we're in companies like Bird, you know, we invested in the A, and then we worked to legalize scooters. Lemonade invested in the A, and then worked to get them insurance licensed in every single state. Roman invested in the C, and then worked to make sure that telemedicine for erectile dysfunction was legal everywhere. Things like that. So we both invest in a startup, work with a startup, get paid in equity also for our work, and combine, that's our venture business.
The thing that I take most from that we try to teach is, there's industries, but that really doesn't matter when you're an entrepreneur or right. When you learn to be profitable. It's the skills that you've gained, the knowledge that you have, the relationship capital
yep.
that you have, and those three things. Because I'm like you, totally. I went all these years in technology and then became the CEO of the most notable sports agency in yep. the world, while every other kid that I went to law school with tried to be Lee Steinberg.
Yeah,
I ended up being the CEO of Lee Steinberg because all I focused in on was being really good at what I do.
Right. Every kid I went to law school with is still probably at a law firm because they're terrified
right. dreaming about my job.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And
yeah.
yet,
but they couldn't do it.
But you focus on these skills.
Yeah, I mean,
but
I
what you do
totally.
Significant though, because until you said it, you know, I know the significance of Uber, right? And you know, you're significant in social economical. Perspective when so many of the world's businesses change because you create a true formula.
Yeah, I mean, that's right? What
people
we try
say,
to
well,
do.
We're a shared economy now.
Right.
Well, Uber started that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting because you said something a minute ago that I always thought also, which is I tried to spend my 20s and like the first half of my 30s just collecting as many skills and experiences, relationships as I could. I didn't worry about money at all. And by the way, I didn't make a lot of money. I'd work in government,
sounds
make
opposite.
A government salary.
I tried to do all three and make money.
Gosh, so you're smarter than me. But my thought was, when the time comes to monetize, which was like, when I have kids, yeah, I'll figure this out.
When you
and,
need money.
Yeah, and luckily we did, but I couldn't do all the things that I do today. And I also own a casino management company and a digital archive company and a bunch of other stuff. If I hadn't had all the experiences leading up to it, and I didn't know exactly where it's all going to go, but if you collect those three things, skills, relationships, and experience, and you're risk-friendly, it can really produce.
Yeah, and it really did. And the interesting thing, though, is that nothing is as it appears. I believe that if you take that non-point of entry, like I'm just going to do the best I can, learn as much as I can, and you worked really hard, but you
yeah,
enjoyed it.
For sure.
But if you take that approach, the universe comes to you with different opportunities.
Yep.
And we don't even know, I call it the suddenness of the universe, that the significance that we put on things is man-made. But if we allow things to happen, there's this greater significance. So I've done a ton of deals for equity, right?
Yep.
I sit on boards of advisors, and I'm conscious about, yeah, it's a lottery ticket, because I'm old enough and I've done so many.
Right.
But it's really funny that your first equity
My first
offer,
deal was Uber, yeah. It turned out pretty well. But another point you're making, I think, is really insightful that people don't often say, which is, if you're doing as many things as you can and you're letting you're being open to the universe, you also have the ability to fail and bounce back a lot more easily. So I had two jobs in a row where I was the deputy governor of Illinois, and my boss was a guy named Rod Blagojevich, ended up with a 14-year jail sentence.
Yeah.
And then I went to go work in investment banking and picked a little-known place called Lehman Brothers about 18 months before they took down the global economy. So those are the two jobs I had in a row. But because I had worked for Mike Bloomberg when he was mayor, and because I had sort of built up this resume and experiences, when he decided to run for a third term, he still called me and said, can you run my campaign? And that obviously got me back on track. But I think by having a diversity of skills and experiences and relationships, it's easier to fail and bounce back.
Yeah, and I think, too, the relationship side of being kind, Lee Steinberg taught me, be kind to your future self. And so although you have failures, a lot of the people that had succeeded with you will discount your failures because they know your character, they know your discipline, they know your skills. And just because you were in a situation that others would look upon, or in a microcosmic way, you know, there's a certain crowd out there that have an opinion of you that were involved, and that's their only opinion of you.
Yeah.
But if you're kind to your future self, you know, I went bankrupt. I lost a portfolio over $100 million.
Wow.
And it really concerned me that, will everybody think of me as a failure? Because I grew up with a mom, you may have one like this, doctor, lawyer, or failure.
Right. Well, you're Jewish like me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
And everything in my life was about how much money I had.
Right.
And my whole identity was tied to that. I got lucky and got into technology out of law school.
Yep.
With skills, though. I was a great salesman. And I used that to...
Which ultimately is a more useful skill than being a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah, exactly.
Turns out.
Yeah, but it was really interesting because of that failure. I was really concerned, and I really want your perspective, because it's a pretty big failure, the Lehman Brothers side of things.
Sure.
Right? And you don't want that on your resume, like, oh, this is my great success,
right,
or the deputy governor situation.
Yeah.
I mean, what was your feeling at that time? Because every entrepreneur has to know that we both felt like shit, and we're like...
I was really afraid. I'll tell you, the Bloomberg campaign in 2009 was a much closer race than anyone understood, because we had changed the law to allow him to run for a third term, so people didn't like that. We were in term limits. He was a billionaire in the middle of a fiscal crisis. So the whole campaign was basically making the world not realize how vulnerable we were, but we were really never up by more than a few points in our own polling. I remember thinking, holy shit, if I have Blagojevich, Lehman, and then lose Bloomberg, I'm going to have to move to Mars. luckily, we pulled it off and won. But part of it also, I think, is character, right? So the reason things worked out for me with Illinois is, one time, Blagojevich slipped up and asked me to do something illegal. It was to extort Rahm and Ari Emanuel, people you know.
Yeah.
And luckily, I said no, and I reported him. And when he got indicted,
so
one
side
of the counts was attempted extortion of Congressman Emanuel, but I was just a witness who kind of was seen to have done the right thing, so it didn't splash back on me. And so, you know, by the way, it was harder saying no to him because he was a crazy guy. And he didn't thank you if you said no to him. He screamed and yelled and threatened.
Yeah.
But the people who said yes ended up either getting indicted or serving time or whatever it was. and the people who said, no, we're okay.
Yeah, it's interesting, even in our own presidential change and shift that we've gone through,
yeah.
I think it's something, and I'm not, you know, gonna bring this into the political side of the show, but I think it's interesting when people say, what side of history do you wanna fall on?
Yeah.
And in business, you know, whether you're in politics or not, there are critical decisions that I've made. In fact, even now, the student athlete thing,
yeah.
You know, I was well, he's right in Newport Beach,
yeah.
Well aware of him. I didn't know what he was doing, but I can imagine in that situation, I was thinking, you know, what if my child was offered this because I know the guy?
Yeah.
And you make that dumb mistake because you want something from your child.
Yes.
These subtleties, it's real simple, it's what we learn as a kid, right from wrong. And we are rewarded, even though there's failures, we're rewarded for being on the right side of history,
yeah,
which is the truth.
For sure. I mean, ultimately, the other thing is this. Let's say that you make it, and you don't get caught, but you've been scheming and lying and cheating the whole time. It's pretty hard to feel good about yourself. Unless you're, in some ways, if you're a sociopath, maybe that's the best of all worlds.
Right,
because
right,
then
right.
You don't care. You
no
don't
names,
no
please.
Guilt, no
this
nothing,
isn't a
right?
political show.
But assuming you're not a sociopath, right, on behalf of politics. You know, it's hard to really feel that good. Along the same lines of, I first sold some of my Uber equity to SoftBank a little over a year ago. It was the first time I really had real money in the bank. And I bought a few stupid things, like I think everybody probably does,
sure,
when they get some money.
And I was worse than most, but yeah,
yeah,
I get it.
And then I realized, like, okay, I have some of these things. It's cool, but okay. And then said, what can I really start doing with my money that would be meaningful to me? And that's when I started Touch Philanthropies. And that's when we started working on changing the way that we vote. So I'm trying to create a world where everyone can vote in elections on their phone over the blockchain. Because if I learned one thing in politics, with the exception of Mike Bloomberg, every politician I dealt with, worked for, against, with, was a desperately insecure, self-loathing person that could not live without the validation of holding office.
Wow.
So they needed that
those are human
affirmation. Yeah, absolutely. But they couldn't live without it. They're asking you or me to not have oxygen. So every decision that they make in office is a result of the political inputs and nothing else. So if you're a Republican congressman from Florida, and turnout in your district is 12%, and let's say because of gerrymandering, there really is no general election, right?
Right.
So you probably know that an assault weapon ban is not a bad idea. You probably don't want people toting an AK-47 around their district, but of that 12%, half are NRA members, and if you vote for the assault weapons ban, they're going to throw you out, which you're never going to do it. But what if turnout were 70%? Then it would reflect how people actually feel, which is most people don't want assault weapons around. What I learned from Uber, as we discussed, is when you give people the tools to advocate politically, i.e. their phone, they will do it. They're not going to go figure out a random Tuesday and wait in line and sit in the rain and all
no
other
doubt.
Stuff. They don't, right?
I vote on the presidential election,
yeah,
but I would vote more if I had
you. I assume you'd vote in pretty much every election.
Yeah.
All you do is go like this, you would just do it by definition.
Of course.
And I think that's basically true for everybody. Seen that in our portfolio.
I don't know enough, obviously, compared to you, about the Electoral College, but how would that type of voting affect the Electoral College?
Which would to a certain extent move us towards popular majority vote.
It would.
Vote.
I
yeah,
would
because
assume so.
If turnout gets to the place, I mean, even a presidential election, which is as high turnout as we get, like 60%, somewhere between 78 and 95% of American adults today have a smartphone. In a couple of years, we'll be at 100%. If everyone has it and every platform, iOS and Facebook and Android, are all bugging you, just remember to vote, remember to vote, just to get the pop-up from stop, just to stop that from keep popping up, you'll vote, right? I think we can get turnout to 80, 90%. And then what the government does will reflect the will of the people because it'll be in their political interest to do so.
But I think for the first time, always since I had the right to vote, the rights of the younger people in America are always underrepresented because
absolutely.
Right, they're not aggregated, unionized, protected, and most of all, they're most apathetic because they don't have situational right. knowledge of dummy tax behind
correct.
Them.
Correct.
Not as significant to vote.
Yeah, well, look, I'm counting
this will change
on,
everything.
Totally, so my daughter's 12. And I'm basically looking at this with a five-year-ish time frame. It's almost, we got our bar mitzvah in a few weeks, it's almost 13. And what I want to do is show over the next 5 years that this thing is safe and that it works. So we did it in West Virginia last year, but we just announced we're doing it in Denver this spring in the municipal elections. Keep doing it in different places. In fact, we're talking Orange County is one of the places we're talking to right now, all over the U.S. So that by the time she's a voting age, she says, bullshit, of course I can vote on my phone. And she demands it. And if enough people of her generation are demanding it, it will happen.
That's the exact approach that I told Gary Vee about his sports agency. I said, forget trying to get the big quarterbacks today. Start hitting the 18-year-olds in college that are your fans.
Right.
When they graduate, Yep. And they're number one draft pick. They're only going to want Gary Vee to rep. They don't care about who used to do it.
Let's assume he doesn't buy the Jets.
Right, yeah. That's going to be a big one with the Johnson. I hope he does.
I mean, look, so as a New York sports fan right now, you know, I think I would lose my season tickets at the Garden if I chanted to sell the Knicks. The Mets are, you know, often a disaster, and the Giants are even worse. So, I'm all for Gary Vee buying all of our teams, quite frankly. I'd be fine with that.
That would be awesome. You know, how did you, one of the things you do is you're a blue ocean thinker. You think outside the box, but it's really interesting the perspective you have because of your political experience is always kind of what the key decision-making power behind what, you know, most entrepreneurs are looking at direct effect.
Yeah.
You see way down the line. Where did that perspective come from? Was it just from doing so many elections that you see?
I mean, it was really a few things. One was learning the true nature of politics and politicians, which is if you understand how to position the thing that you want them to do, it's either this will unelect you if you don't do it, or this will reelect you if you do it, they'll usually do it. And once I understood that, then I could apply it to our portfolio company and say, okay, you know, Bird or Lemonade or Circle or Coinbase or Roman or FanDuel or any of these companies, they're going to have these problems at around these times. Let me anticipate that as much as I possibly can and develop strategies to preempt and mitigate it as much as possible. And one of the things I look for when we invest in startups is, are they smart enough to recognize that these problems are going to come and do they want to deal with them? The ones who keep their heads in the sand and say, I'll just figure it out later. You know, by the time, if you're first starting to figure it out when the shit hits the fan, it never really works out. If you're thoughtful enough during the seed or series A to say, I recognize that if I succeed, I'm going to have these challenges. How do I build the capabilities to deal with them? Those are the kind of people I want to invest in.
Yeah, and you're kind of like the wizard of the Wizard of Oz. You're letting.
I'm not sure that's a compliment.
It is. It is because I'm thinking through. And I've been blessed in my career. You know, CEO of the first smartphone company, CEO of the most notable sports agency, Sports One Marketing founder of Warren Moon.
Yeah.
Like all these things that I do. But I'm looking at, through history, the significant, just Uber alone, without someone like you, but it happened to be you, but even the failure side of it, like the world's first smartphone, or the world's first Windows C device, it was a big failure to start. Now, the Samsung division of phones blew up.
Right.
It did great. But I'm thinking, you know, you have a governor that, you know, basically is impeached and arrested.
Yep.
Then you have Lehman Brothers, which is one of the most historical financial things that have ever happened.
Just about the biggest,
Then Uber.
Yeah.
Right, and now you're changing the actual, all the voting.
Trying,
You're trying, but.
You give Mike Bloomberg some credit.
I get it. Yeah. What significance, you know, of your legacy? Now, I look back and go, what legacy do I want to leave?
Right.
With all of that, what legacy would, or message would you like to leave?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot. There are three things that I'm doing.
Which is rare, by the way. Most, because I could tell you're a legacy thinker. Most people, when I ask
them,
it throws me off, because I'm like, what do you mean you don't think about your legacy?
Right.
But this is great.
I think that's a lot. So there are three things, really, to me. One is, because we're the only venture capital fund that's focused on politics and regulation, I want to change the way that startups are regulated. I want them to get a fair shake at the apple. So with Uber, what we always found was you had this pay-to-play corruption where the taxi medallion owners would give political contributions to the regulators and to the city council and the mayor, and they would use that to get them to lean on us to try to shut us down. We won with Uber, but it happens to thousands of startups, right? And most of them we never hear about. And I could at any given moment, me and my team work with a dozen and protect them, fine, but there's still tens of thousands left. I want a world where they're not extorted or screwed over in the first place. The first is, how do I take the things that I'm working on and make them universal enough that that becomes the norm? The second is, how do I create a world where the will of majority is what our politicians actually do, and that's combining technology and politics? And the third, so I wrote a book that came out last fall as a memoir, and we haven't announced it yet, but I can say we sold it to a major TV network, and I'm now writing the pilot for the TV show.
Oh, nice.
Is, you know, what can I do through my writing to influence the way people think, the way they act, and you know, how do I interact with the world that way? So to me, those are the three things that I'm really focused on.
That is awesome. And I love these types of episodes of The Playbook because we really got into the true playbook to success, not the surface side of it, and see the inner workings, not only of politics, technology, but venture capital and philanthropy.
Yeah.
And what I've realized by talking with you, Bradley, is that the skills are all the same.
Yeah.
Like you literally do the exact same thing in your that you developed from that 20 years.
Yeah.
You do it whether it's for charity, whether it's, you know, for voting,
yeah,
whether it's for, you know,
our investors, Uber, whatever it is.
Which is crazy.
Uber, yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean it's amazing.
Other than remembering which meeting I'm walking into and I'm walking into it, basically it's the same skill set. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do tons of these, but any of you entrepreneurs out there, you better watch this 2 or 3 times to figure out when you're trying to figure out how do I get where I want to be.
Yeah.
This is a great Formula One for the playbook.
Appreciate it.
Bradley Tusk.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
What an honor.
Yes.
Yeah, Dave Meltzer, entrepreneur, the playbook. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making the playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with the playbook.